I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. Once upon a time, we would have gotten much of our news from newspapers. But over the last 60 years, the enormous popularity of television changed all that. Really big stories, like this one just a few weeks ago, can come to life almost instantly on our TV screens. I think we've got a clip in the control room. We're queuing it up.
Good morning. Breaking news. A mass shooting inside a suburban Denver movie theater overnight. At least 14 people are dead, 50 others injured. A chaotic and terrifying scene. This morning, a 24-year-old man is under arrest. We'll have complete coverage today, Friday, July 20th, 2012.
That was Matt Lauer on the Today Show reporting on the Aurora, Colorado shootings just a few hours after they happened, while Colorado was still under a blanket of darkness. And today we're talking about the changing journalism landscape with some people who know the industry inside and out. And Dan Kennedy from Northeastern University, I'm going to start with you. You think about journalism and write about it a lot. You're here on WGBH's Beat the Press on Fridays. I think one of the really interesting things about the Aurora, Colorado shooting was that only 44% of Americans learned about it from TV. So TV, as you know, you heard Matt Lauer all over it, and CNN dropped everything. And yet, I'll break it down even further, only 21% of those between 18 and 24 heard about it from TV. What does that tell you about how we're changing our news diet?
Well, I think that television, maybe newspapers were kind of a leading indicator of this trend, but actually everything is giving way to people being online and getting their news that way. And maybe people were sitting in front of their computer. Maybe people were following Twitter on their smartphone. And in all likelihood, they found out about it that way because, I mean, after all, actually, I think the time of day had something to do with it, too. It was not a time of day when very many people would be sitting in front of the TV.
Yeah, and you do see this sort of age disparity. So when I give 44% of Americans learn from the shooting from TV, it's really misleading because more than 58% of those 65 and older learned of it from TV. But like I said, hardly anybody who's 18 to 24, or even if you look at 25 to 34, sort of young professionals,
sure,
only 34% of them learned of it from TV.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, that might be partly a function of what news technology you're comfortable with. Frankly, in this particular case, it sounds like more of a reflection of who was home with the TV on and who wasn't. I mean, obviously, people who were older and perhaps retired may very well have had the TV on, whereas the people in the younger demographic were out either working or, given this economy, looking for a job.
And what ends up happening is the people who are between 18 and, let's say, 35 start to replace as viewers and consumers, people who are over 65, as will inevitably happen. Do they become people who are more tied to print and to paper, or do they end up hurting print and paper more because that's not where they get their news?
Well, I don't see why people who are living entirely without paper at the moment would be looking to gravitate to paper at some point in the future. I just don't see any reason for that. You know, I'm going to offer an interesting observation that was made to me by Mark Oppenheimer, who is this polymath who might be known to our listeners mainly for writing a religion column in the New York Times. But he's one of the people who I interviewed for my book on online local news sites. And he was telling me that he thought that even if you had a free newspaper for local people, this was in New Haven, Connecticut, that we were talking about, he didn't really think that people would go for it because it doesn't fit into people's lives anymore. He said that online is really where you have to reach people because they can take a look a couple of times during the day when they're at work, and that's when they squeeze it into their busy lives. So the idea of this, what used to be maybe an evening ritual for people, and then 20, 30 years ago became a morning ritual of reading the paper, has now just become at best something that people are able to fit into their lives at odd moments during the day. And with that type of mentality, it really has to be electronic in some way, whether it's on the web or on your smartphone or whatever.
So eventually you're going to get to the point where it's not a question of pricing the print product right. There is no price that would be right.
No, there is absolutely no price that would be right because it doesn't fit into people's lives.
Right, right, right.
And they didn't do it when they were younger. They're just not going to gravitate to that.
Josh Benton, director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard, let me bring you in here. What do you make of the fact that here is a story, the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, that's very visual, that TV, like I said, was all over, and yet young people quite clearly neither get their news from newspapers nor from TV. What does that say to you about what's going on?
Well, I can speak from my own experience. I was, for some reason, getting up early that day, and I got up and I was doing something like 70% of smartphone owners do, which is the first thing you do as soon as you wake up is reach over for your phone and check your email or check Twitter or whatever your info source of choice is.
How close do you sleep to your smartphone?
Within arm's length. It's
okay.
Right there.
Just checking.
Yes. And I started looking on Twitter and started seeing these things, you know, a couple hours after it had happened. And I immediately started going to websites and seeing, you know, being a little disappointed, honestly, that a few sites that I, you know, CNN and New York Times were not updated quickly enough. So I then shifted into, you know, information mode, like, bet the Denver Post has some good stuff. Let me go check what their Twitter feed says and sort of on that hunt. But I think you see in a lot of these cases, and I had a similar experience when Gabby Giffords was shot, was that what starts off as a digital experience can sometimes become a communal television experience. You know, I remember when the shooting happened in Arizona, I learned about it digitally, learned about it on my phone, and then immediately said, I got to turn on CNN to see what that shared experience is like. And I think that's part of how television executives are thinking about this, is thinking of television as part of a two-screen experience. So you're not going to stop people from having the phone in their hand or the tablet in their hand, but maybe you're adding something else that can have a different dimension. And just to jump off of something that Dan said, I think that you're absolutely right that one thing that has happened as digital has become more important is that news consumption has shifted from being something you do at home to something you do at work. And that's certainly been the case. And actually, there's some interesting studies that look at how we consume different kinds of news in a work environment versus at home. But this is an area where I think devices, smartphones, and particularly tablets, are shifting in the opposite direction. If you look at when people use their iPads, they use them in the evening overwhelmingly. It's a thing that you use on your couch or in your bed. Smartphones, as we talked about, you know, something that you use in bed. There's something about the decoupling of the desk experience or the laptop experience, which does imply a certain kind of environment that I think some people are looking towards as a way to try and repackage the news in a way that could make sense for news companies. But to take your previous question, I don't think print fits into this in anything other than in the long term, a really nice experience for a small minority of customers who are going to be interested in having a really nice print product. And you look at what the Globe has done, for example, raising their circulation rates quite substantially. They're doing that. They're not doing that because they think they're going to get young customers to sign up for a subscription.
Right.
They're doing that because they think we have a smaller and over time shrinking audience of people who want print. They tend to be richer than they used to be on average. They tend to be, you know, have a certain socioeconomic status. We should charge them through the nose and get as much as we can out of them.
This is a product they really want. This
exactly.
is really desirable, and they're going to, within reason, pay for it.
Right. So print becomes a luxury good.
Okay. You know, one question about where you went when you looked at the Aurora, Colorado shooting and you wanted to find out what was going on. Were you going to Facebook? Were you going to Twitter? Were you going to were you going to big sites like Huffington Post? What did you expect would have good coverage?
Well, I started off on Twitter because I'm just a Twitter guy, much more than a Facebook kind of guy. And also because Twitter is really effective as a discovery engine. When something happens right away, Twitter is going to be the first place to have it. Sometimes that gets labeled as Twitter breaking a story, and I think that's probably pushing it a bit too far. But if you want something that just happened, Twitter's the place to go. And then from there, I started to say, let me see what I can get through feeds. I noticed that there were a few people who were doing a really active job of retweeting things. There was a producer for a Denver television station who was doing a lot of good work. There was someone who works for Reuters who was doing a lot of work. And you start to sort of figure out. And this is how Twitter and social media works. People discover things and then share it with their networks. And over time, you start to realize, hey, this is the guy to watch. But once I got out of bed, eventually, I did go to my computer. And there, it was a matter of checking out the Denver Post and figuring out who are the local sources on the scene who are going to have the most immediate information.
We've got on the phone Jennifer Aitley, who has written for the New York Times and is currently working on a book about digital devices and connectivity. So let me ask you, Jennifer, about digital devices. You know, Josh Benton from Neiman talks about this idea of going to Twitter, figuring out who are the best people to follow. But that, as far as I can tell, does not have any money involved. He's following them for free. They're tweeting for free. So, you know, where do the resources come in terms of actually covering what happened in Aurora, Colorado?
So in terms of a lot of the stuff that comes in now is what I call sort of primary source journalism. So it's not necessarily just the tweets, but you see it in different things like video. There was, you know, obviously a lot of very moving first-person sort of video shot on smartphones during that time, which we've seen. And we've seen that sort of over the last couple of years, like very sort of personal breaking video footage of news events. And so a lot of it is just people sharing stuff, and people are compelled to share in this world. It's kind of how we communicate. It's kind of how we make social connections. And so that kind of like primary level is coming at almost very low cost because of the witnesses that are there. The harder part, the more expensive part, is when you need much more context, or you need to bring someone from, let's say, from out of that situation to fly in order to give more analysis and context to the situation. So that is where you're going to see a lot more of the cost. But in terms of some of the stuff on like an immediate level, it's people just sharing what they see.
So it sounds like what it really is in a lot of ways is crowdsourcing. I mean, you're sort of taking the best information from different people. They're not really involved in it monetarily, but there might be a good eyewitness account here and something else there. I mean, do you think of this as kind of crowdsourcing the news?
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of what I call like the little brother phenomenon. So we always historically, you know, with 1984 and George Orwell, feared that like the government would get more power as technology became more ubiquitous. But in reality, what we've seen is much more of a little brother kind of thing, where people, it is more likely the people around you who will capture you in an indiscriminate moment with their cell phones, or someone who has a USB drive with access to, you know, places you might have documents. So in fact, we're actually turning the lens and the observation on each other. And in a way, it is very much sort of a crowdsourced way of observing the world and sharing.
That's really interesting. So I'm going to go to Tom Steitz, who is the former editor at the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune, and founder of the Banyan Project. And Tom Steitz, I wonder, I mean, obviously you've worked for big organizations, the Times and the Chicago Tribune. Do you feel like we're really losing something fundamentally by losing that sort of central voice? Like, let's say the Boston Globe, which once had many, many more bureaus than it does and could send people out and spend money in all sorts of different ways. Or are we gaining something in terms of crowdsourcing?
How about both?
Okay. So talk a little bit about what you see in terms of the losses and the gains.
Well, not much of the discourse about the future of journalism talks about distribution of a common set of stories and things that people then can talk about together. And there are no small number of people who think that it's not important that we're losing that, and some who actually think it's good that we're losing that. So there's a spectrum of opinion about it. But it is certainly a change in the culture. When people lose sort of a common ground of conversation about the political and civic life of our country and our communities. I think that there's an awful lot of very important reporting that gets done that is so little distributed that it's almost like shouting into a cave. And that's a loss to the world. And how we solve the problem of opening big, wide doors for lots of people to find that, I think, is something that we could wisely put a lot more energy into thinking about.
Josh Benton, do we have a serious problem in that people, you know, you think back to Walter Cronkite and that's the way it is. People have a very different understanding now of the way it is. You know, I may, my reading habits and your reading habits and Dan's reading habits and time, it may give us all a very different sense of the way things are in the country so that we may have no sort of common understanding, set of common facts, even though we live in the same state in the same country.
Well, we all listen to public radio, of course.
So we all, we're on the same page. Yeah, exactly.
Common understanding. I would say I sort of am on the side of being skeptical about how common that conversation ever really was.
Okay.
You know, it's calming to think of a time when everyone got the same newspaper and read it from page one to through the classifieds every day. And the United States had a unique media culture compared to many other countries. You know, you go to the, say, go to Great Britain and you see a place that has seven national dailies that all have ideological slices of the audience and class slices of the audience, and kind of a place that could, that never really had the illusion of having those common conversations the way that the United States, where we ended up with a lot of cities that had one newspaper or at most two newspapers, such as here in Boston. And I think that, you know, those conversations were never quite as common as we'd like to think that they were.
I should say, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, we did in many cities have a Democratic paper, a Republican paper. You know, right leaning, left leaning.
Ten Democratic papers
choose.
And ten
exactly.
Republican papers, exactly. And that's, you know, if you looked at newspapers in those days, it looks a lot closer to what the blogosphere looked like in the early 2000s, for example. You know, I think that one thing that social media does really well is focus a group's attention on things that it did not expect to be focused on. You can look at that at the low end. You can look at, you know, cat pictures that get shared on Facebook, that, you know, memes that blow up and end up getting shared very widely. Or you can look at, you know, big events like Aurora and others where I don't think that anyone who was I don't think that there was a real loss of communal identity of knowing that this thing was happening because no one was reading the Boston Globe. You know, just in that particular case, of course, it's at the exact wrong time for any newspaper to have something happen at right after midnight,
right,
two time zones away. But I think that digital does a better job of creating that communal space. Or actually, what it does is it does a better job of creating many of those communal spaces that are not, that no longer have the illusion of being continent-wide, but are still really important to the groups of people who are in them. And I think it can also be a lot more representative of the, you know, the diversity of ideas and the diversity of perspectives that we have in this country.
I want to talk more about that and how politics and local coverage factors in. We're talking about how the landscape of journalism is changing and how the way we get our news has evolved over the decades. I'm Kara Miller. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.
NBA players make big money, which is often gone by the time they stop playing, so welcome to the forced retirement plan.
They have to manage their money as though they are 60-year-old men about to retire.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Safety nets for ballers. We'll have the numbers from Wall Street and the day's business news as well next time on Marketplace. It's from APM, American Public Media.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Bridge Bank, building long-term relationships with entrepreneurs and businesses throughout the country and with East Coast offices in Boston and in Reston, Virginia. You can find them on the web at bridgebank.com. And members of the Ralph Lowell Society, these most generous annual contributors lead the way in sustaining WGBH as a public media resource, available and free to all. WGBH.org/Ralph Lowell.
I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio. If you're just joining us, we are talking about how the landscape of journalism is changing and how the way we get our news has really evolved over the decades. And joining me in Studio 3 are Josh Benton, director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard, Tom Steitz, a former editor at the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune and founder of the Banyan Project, Dan Kennedy, assistant professor at Northeastern and a frequent contributor to WGBH's Beat the Press, and on the phone, Jennifer Eatley, who has written for the New York Times and is currently working on a book about digital devices and connectivity. And Dan, I've got to go to you on this issue of, are we all living in the same media universe? We've got a clip from Arianne Huffington in 2008 where she's talking about whether the media is biased, sort of in response to the common allegation that the media skews liberal. And here's what she has to say.
The problem with the media is not that they are veering to the left or veering to the right, but that they have an addiction to presenting two sides to every issue, even when the truth lies on one side or the other. And that's why I describe them as the Pontius Pilate media. And just to give you a couple of examples, global warming. We've wasted years debating global warming with the media presenting, let's say, Al Gore or the equivalent, discussing the dangers of global warming. And on the other hand, Senator James Inhofe or Michael Crichton telling us that global warming is a fraud. Now, these two positions are not of equal value. So the media's responsibility has always been to ferret out the truth.
Dan Kennedy, are we in danger of a media landscape that is so ideologically divided that it is like we live in two separate countries?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that you see this reflected in our completely fractured political culture today. We're dealing with a presidential campaign right now that isn't about issues at all. It's about tribalism, cultural signifiers, and all the rest. And it's because we all have such completely different worldviews. And part of that, I think, is although I think Arianna Huffington made some good points there, I'm still trying to wrap my arms around a pretty amazing study I saw last week that that Pew had put out, showing that people don't trust the media because they believe it's biased. And then they went down a little bit into the findings and they said, okay, when you hear the term news organization, what comes to mind? And Fox News was the first thing they cited, and CNN was second, and MSNBC was fairly high up on the list too. And what I thought was really interesting about that isn't that it was necessarily a reflection of people's biases so much as it was they are thinking of talk shows as news. They're thinking of ideological talk shows as news. Okay, CNN doesn't necessarily do ideological talk shows, but nevertheless, their prime time when most of the people are watching is
and
talk
shows.
And
aren't they quite a bit cheaper than, you know, getting somebody to go out to Paris and do some reporting on the government in Paris, or getting somebody to go to Beijing and open a bureau there?
Oh, it's much cheaper, of course. Absolutely. The other thing that I thought was interesting about this was people were asked, do you think the media gets it right or wrong most of the time? And they overwhelmingly said the media get it wrong most of the time. Then they said, do you think the media that you rely on every day get it right or wrong most of the time? Actually, it was overwhelmingly, oh, they get it right. I like my media.
Well, this is like the classic, I like my congressman, but Congress is a disaster,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So, Jenny Lee, I wonder, you're obviously, I mean, I follow your Twitter feed and I know that you're on devices all the time. Do you worry, though, that it's those devices in some ways that pulls us apart a little bit, at least maybe not when it comes to sports coverage, or maybe not when it comes to coverage of the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, but maybe when it comes to politics and issues of the federal government?
Well, these devices actually, I mean, my book actually looks a lot at actually how they affect us emotionally and behaviorally. So not even just in terms of like the politics, but even on a simple behavioral level, there is something like 30% of people have used your device in order to avoid talking to other people. Like, you know, like you're in an elevator or something, you sort of seem busy. And it's become a way, you know, while it connects us to people who are remotely, sometimes it separates us from people who are like right there in front of us.
And you so can take refuge. You can take refuge in your iPhone. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so it's sort of, You know, and it's a big debate whether, you know, how this affects our communication abilities. But it's sort of like a car. Like, does a car separate us or connect us together? It does both, right? Because in some ways it lets you try, you know, kind of travel more distances. But at the same time, because it creates bubbles around you in suburbia, it also kind of separates you. And I think that's also the sort of double-edged sword of these digital devices that have, you know, one, a phenomenon persistent connectivity, and also, like, they cause what I call... a creative, a social magnetic field that, like, pulls us in all the time.
Since we're talking about the Huffington Post, let's listen to a little clip here of Tim Armstrong, who's the chairman and CEO of America Online, and he's talking about why America Online bought the Huffington Post for $315 million last year.
The investments over the last decade have been in platforms and infrastructures, Google, Twitter, Facebook, Apple. Yeah. All of those platforms work, and generally the first or second most done thing in those platforms is content sharing. So if you think about that, and we just did a research study last year, people typically use 20 content brands a month on the internet. They use 14 on cable television. If you connect the dots between the investments in platforms, the mass scale and connectivity, the mass scale and devices and tablets and all those things, and realize all of that has got to be fueled by content, and you look at a property like the Huffington Post or other properties of ours like TechCrunch and Engadget and MoviePhone, it's not hard to marry those two visions together and think that the most important thing in the next phase, the internet, is going to be content. And then when you look at the opportunity for advertisers who've been trailing that migration of investments in platforms and consumers, you know, advertisers are going to need content to connect to consumers. And I think Ariana and I are both incredibly passionate about it, not just at a global or national level, but also at a local level.
Tom Stites, is there the possibility for sites like the Huffington Post to be substitutes for very, you know, what used to be very big, either television or print organizations? Maybe we all used to read the Boston Globe or the St. Louis Dispatch when we woke up. But, you know, is the Huffington Post taking its place and uniting us in that way?
Well, it has a huge followership, bigger than most newspapers. So I think the answer is that it's already doing that, and I think it continues to spread. But I'd like to go another place. I'd like to go back to the question you asked Dan, which is, are we living in two different media worlds? I think the number is bigger than two. The conversation we've been having, and I agree with, I have no disagreement with anything that anybody said today, is about people who are really engaged in the media all the time. The Pew people did a study that came out about a month ago that says that we're now up to the point that 13% of Americans have Twitter accounts and 8% of Americans are on Twitter every day. We're talking as if everyone's always on Twitter. We're also talking about the Boston Globe raising its price because they understand that their readers are affluent people and they can get more money from them. Well, then there's all those other people. We're also talking about people who can update themselves two or three times a day on their desktop at work. 80% of people in America, working people at least, the working population, works for hourly wages. Many of them wear steel-toed boots and drive trucks and hammer nails. And
so
do
they're
things
not sitting
like
in front of a monitor all day.
Yeah. And I am concerned, deeply concerned, that the way we cover the news needs to be able to inform everybody. And not just the people, the 8% who are on Twitter every day, the people that's in, and so forth and so on. We're now to the place that nearly 80% of American households have internet access at home. We're also to the place where almost everybody who doesn't have it at home has has a smartphone. That's where a lot of people who are less affluent access the internet. This is wonderful, but the smartphones in terms of news are much better for snacking than they are for gourmet meals. And if you're more affluent people, you can probably have your choice in both. So I think that there's a significant issue here that doesn't get a whole lot of attention, but it affects an awful lot of people. And that's a lot about what the Banyan Project is about.
Let's get to that in 1 second, Josh Benton. You were going to get in here.
I just want to say I agree that there's a relationship between people being ignorant and people being divided. But in a lot of cases, the relationship is the opposite. There's a professor at Emory, Alan Abramovich, who's done some interesting studies looking at high information voters versus low information voters. That describes, you know, people who pay a lot of attention or people who don't pay much attention at all. And his findings have consistently shown that as people's information levels go up, so does their polarization. If you do a survey of people and ask them, are you extremely on the right, extremely on the left, and you judge that from how they answer questions, and then you ask them factual questions. Do you know how many Supreme Court justices can you name? You know, what party controls the House of Representatives? The people who are extremes on either side are also the most informed people. And if you look at, you know, I always wonder whenever I see a presidential poll and it's, you know, 48% Obama and 47% Romney, and I think, who doesn't have an opinion yet at this point? You know, oftentimes they're the people in the middle who don't have an opinion are the least informed people. So it's easy to assume that the more information leads to like people living in their own information universes causes this. But in a lot of cases, it's people who actually have the opportunity to learn about things, and that just informs a more extreme point of view on either side.
I'm actually not surprised. It stands to reason, logically, that it's only the really interested people who are going to seek out the Rachel Maddows and the Sean Hannitys. I mean, you have to have a fair amount of interest and conviction to care about what those people have to say.
And free time.
That's right. Exactly. And free time. So, Tom States, let me just go back to what you had said. You've actually written before that in many less affluent communities, what we're looking at really are news deserts. Mm-hmm. Talk about why that is.
Well, first you've got to divide journalism into several slices. And when you get down to the ground where people have experiences that are newsworthy, in the community where I live, the dump stinks. This is news, but you don't have to be able to read. You can get it with your nose, you know what I mean? But it's also a running story in the local newspaper. This isn't an issue that is metropolitan in scope, regional in scope, or national in scope. I mean, there are tinges that you can get to if you work hard enough, but it's local. If the streets in your community are chock full of potholes, that's a local issue. When you get down to that level of journalism, there are an awful lot of communities that essentially have none or have so little that it is almost imperceptible. An awful lot of people have always largely read local newspapers, largely had local perspectives on the news, but the local media would bring them things from the outside in the nation and the world. That's going too. So I think that a lot of what Josh is saying, which is absolutely true, I read the same study, also has to do with largely the people who have time and access and so forth. There's still these people who don't have access. So what I'm much more concerned about, because nobody else is in that space. I get the space pretty to myself. I wish I didn't. I wish I had allies. But I'm down at the ground level. And I shouldn't say I'm not alone there, but there are people, and Dan's writing about a bunch of them, down at the ground level. Not nearly enough, where people can find out about things of civic interest as opposed to high-level political abstractions in policy and so forth that we tend to talk about on public radio and other places.
And you're working on a project in Haverhill, Massachusetts,
correct.
A sort of community journalism project to restore
right.
journalism to a community that's missing it
that's
in
right.
large sense.
I look at that there are three major problems for most people in America in terms of journalism. First is, all the business models that we've had are collapsing, and they're going to keep on collapsing until they're, you know, wrecked, if they survive at all. Two, not everybody is served. More and more, it's only the affluent being served, even remotely well. And the third is, as Dan was talking about, this lack of general lack of trust, although there are specific ways that that's not the case. And so if you can't solve problems two and three if you don't have viable, sustainable, replicable business models. This is what I've been working on now for about 3.5 years. And what I've come up with is, I hope, what will prove to be a sustainable, replicable business model that will be able to be planted in community after community after community. And in Haverhill, north of Boston, we are doing a pilot project. It will be known as Haverhill Matters. And the point that the difference in the business model from everything else that's being tried now is that it will be a cooperative. It will be owned by its readers.
Like a food co-op.
That's right.
Like
the way that shoppers own a food co-op or depositors own a credit union. And so you'll have a community information institution, a journalism institution that's owned by a widely dispersed several hundred people in the community who operate their own community information source. in response to the community's needs. Now, how to get that, make this work right is subtle, and we're working on that. And we have support from the National Cooperative Business Association and so forth that want to see this work. And if Haverhill Matters works, and there's smart, wonderful, terrific, committed people in Haverhill working on it, make it work, then it will be presumably replicable, and they can be planted in news deserts like cactuses, and everybody will do better at the civic level.
And that'll be fascinating to see, and we'll check back in on it. Jennifer and Lee, I want to ask you a question related to this issue of local news, but sort of a broader question. I feel like I've noticed amongst people who are in their 20s and 30s that they simply are not as engaged with kind of local and regional news as maybe people once were, because they grew up reading the Huffington Post and CNN. So you ask them who, you know, the Speaker of the House is in Massachusetts, they don't know. I mean, and they don't care, really. I wonder if you also see that and what you see happening in terms of local news.
So one of the things that I've observed very much is that instead of a broadcast model, which has been historic, one of the things that is really driving young people in terms of how they consume news is the sharing model, right? And so it's in their feeds and Twitter, it's in Facebook. And so as much as, so one of the big challenges that state and local news has to figure out is like, how do they turn the things that they cover into items of news that people feel compelled to share. And the thing is, actually, the neighborhood blogs have done really quite well along those lines, precisely because they have personality, they cover issues that are sort of immediate interest, and they also have a much more sense of like two-way communication with their audience. And the struggle has been toward more for legacy institutions to kind of transform what historically has been sort of much more an online relationship with their audience into things that will travel along the feed, if that makes sense. So I've been working a lot with sort of startups that are basically focused on how do you make something shareable, and especially if it's meaningful. And that's actually a very difficult challenge. It's a different set of toolkits and style of communication, but at the same time, everyone wants to do the same thing, which is take, you know, important information that causes people to be engaged in their communities and make it important and appealing to them.
We've got a little bit of connection troubles. We're going to try to iron it out. Let me throw this to Dan Kennedy. Can we do what Jennifer Lee says and create something on a local level that people feel compelled to share and people can make money doing? Because right now that there is a fundamental money problem that's plaguing local and regional, I should say regional newspapers, right? The New Orleans Times-Picayune, the Boston Globe, St. Louis Dispatch, meaning around the country, Seattle papers.
Well, I mean, my interest is more local than regional. And my major interest has been in New Haven. And they have had a great deal of success there. Now, I don't know whether people are ever going to pump a lot of profits out of hyperlocal journalism. I think if you go back several generations, the truth is they never did. But Tom is talking about one model, this idea of a news co-op, which is very interesting. At the moment, the model that seems to be working the best is the nonprofit model, where you have a combination of local institutions sponsoring the site, foundation grants, contributions from readers like you, and that's working fairly well. One of the big challenges to the nonprofit model at the moment, and maybe this co-op that Tom talks about will get around it, is that first of all, there's a limit to how much foundation money is out there, but more important, the IRS has put the brakes on this because. There's a sense that this does not fit their traditional idea of what a nonprofit ought to be. So whereas some nonprofits like the New Haven Independent, Voice of San Diego, the Connecticut Mirror, kind of got in under the wire a few years ago, there were more recent projects that have come along that have essentially been shut down because they were unable to win that nonprofit status. And although I'm certainly not a big fan of the idea of government support of journalism, it seems to me that this is a fairly indirect way of supporting journalism that the government ought to get behind, and it would be nice to see the IRS move off the dime with this.
And are there local news coverage organizations, let's say, not even papers, that are making it work, that are, maybe aren't pumping out huge profits, but are paying decent salaries to the people who cover news?
Are we talking, are you talking specifically for profit?
In New Haven, you talked about New Haven, San Diego, right?
Yes.
Connecticut Mirror.
Those organizations are paying people livable salaries. The five full-time journalists who work for the New Haven Independent are not making any financial sacrifice in working for a nonprofit online-only news organization as opposed to working for a traditional community newspaper. I think we sometimes tend to forget that nobody ever got rich doing this anyway.
Right. Josh Benton, are we headed, I mean, we talked, of course, about newspapers at the beginning. Are we headed towards a world in which a lot of local sites do spring up to take the place of newspapers, or in which there's a lot of news deserts that arise?
I think that we've kind of gone past a stage of optimism about that, which we had a couple years ago when there was this hope that sites like the New Haven Independent, Voice of San Diego on a larger scale, and hyperlocal sites and neighborhood blogs and things would fill more of the void than I think that they have. I think what we've learned is that if you want to, you know, be successful doing that, you need to have a very committed leader, a very committed person running the show who has to be quite talented. You need to be in a certain kind of community where local advertisers are going to support it, local institutions are going to support it. And frankly, there aren't a lot of those communities. Or at the very least, they haven't proven to be a lot of those communities. So we were just talking before we went on air that, you know, it's the same circle of five or six places that we've been talking about now for half a decade as the great hyperlocal success stories. And if it was a more replicable model, I feel it would have been replicated a lot more than it has. And that's one of the differences from newspapers. I mean, newspapers in this country worked in New York City and they worked in my small hometown of Rain, Louisiana, and every scale in between. It was always a profitable business. You know, it emerged in this monopoly market where you could charge monopoly rates to advertisers and make a lot of money, or at least make a very solid living. And I'm a little bit pessimistic, frankly, but I think the counterbalance to that is look at what the audience wants. Part of the reason why people consumed a lot of locally generated content before the internet was because that was the content they had access to. You know, and if you lived in Topeka, Kansas, you couldn't read the New York Times every day, so you read whatever the local paper in Topeka, Kansas was.
Right.
And that was how the distribution method worked, and the flip side of that was that encouraged them to have someone covering Topeka City Council. There's people consume lots of media. It's just that it's national media, it's global media, and that's why, you know, the New York Times is going to be fine at the end of this because they have this huge audience that's been opened up to them. For local news and local news institutions, I think it's a lot more challenging because if you're a young person in America today, your life is much less local than it used to be before the internet came along.
Tom Stites, you talk to people who cover politics for the Boston Globe or the Boston Herald or really in many papers around this country, and they say, you know, gee, when I started covering politics, the press room, the press gallery, it used to be full. Now there's like five people there, or if we're lucky. I mean, do you see things fundamentally changing here? And you know, in a way where that press gallery has fewer and fewer people in it.
Yeah, absolutely. They're like deserts in the press galleries as well. Can I jump on something that Josh was talking about? I think that, you know, again, when you get down close to the ground, there really are issues that make people lose sleep at night. There are things that cause people angst, and they want to know more. They need better information. The way I define journalism these days to get out of that conversation about I don't trust anything and anybody, yeah, but is that journalism is reliable information that people need to make their best life and citizenship decisions. Nobody says they need less of that. There are an awful lot of people who need lots more of it. And that if we can try to find ways to bring that to communities, including with blogs. One of the things that we're talking about with Haverhill Matters is to have a blog in every neighborhood that's brought together in the community journalism institution that will be the cooperative, which incidentally is another revenue source to get back to that. But that's not what this is about. But the fact is that there is a huge need for reliable information you need to make your best life as a citizenship decisions, and we need to find ways to do that.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what, if anything,
not
fills
just what
that
comes
void.
Out of the press rooms and that's in the State House.
Right.
Yeah, not just, we need that too.
Tom State's a former editor at the New York Times and Chicago Tribune and founder of the Banyan Project. Josh Benton, director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard. Jennifer Aitonly, who has written for the New York Times and is currently working on a book about digital devices and connectivity, and Dan Kennedy, assistant professor at Northeastern and a frequent contributor to WGBH's Beat the Press and author of the blog Media Nation, which you must follow. Thanks very much to all of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Callie Crossley is back in Studio 3.
Hey, Kara. Well, whether you saw it on TV or read it online, Mitt Romney can't stop making the headlines. I'm going to be talking to our political watchdogs about how his trip abroad went. But first, we're going to talk about local news coming out of the State House with a focus on the three strikes legislation. And Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown, both of their campaigns, taking heat from partisan critics.
That will be interesting. That will be interesting. And when the legislature wraps up this year, there's going to be even less news to cover during this kind of sleepy season, potentially.
All too true.
Yeah. I'm Kara Miller.
And I'm Callie Crossley. And this is Boston Public Radio.